Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here, early. Right now at Wayfair, get up to 70% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, holiday decor, and way more. Now is the time to score big, from seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, with Wayfair, enjoy fast and easy shipping, with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 70% off early Black Friday deals. Shop now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Welcome to the Vegan Report. My name is Ryan, and today we are discussing the role of spirituality in the vegan movement. According to a 2017 survey, 73% of vegans self-identify as atheists or agnostics. That's why I know this might not be the most popular opinion, but I deeply believe that leading a spiritual practice is not only a powerful way to deal with the struggle of being an outspoken vegan in a non-vegan world, but also an essential part of a happy, healthy life. To discuss the power of spirituality, I'm joined by Victoria Moran. Victoria is a longtime animal activist, successful author. She has written more than 13 books, a fellow podcaster. She is the host of the Main Street Vegan Podcast. Go check it out. And yogi. During the interview, Victoria references many great resources to kickstart your spiritual journey. Visit the episode's notes to access each of her recommendations and connect with her. As always, I invite you to follow the show, share the podcast with the staunch atheist you know, and spark an interesting conversation. Leave a good review. Every gesture of support is appreciated. Thank you. Victoria, thank you so much for having accepted my invitation.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So, thinking about the conversation we were about to have, what came to mind were multiple conversations, starting with one I had with Gary Yourofsky. So he has been a very polemic figure these past few weeks since his return from retirement. I had the exclusive interview with him, little time after, he announced that he was back. People highlighted many parts of that interview, but I guess the one part of the interview that truly stayed with me was the beginning, where he talked about his struggle as a longtime animal rights activist, how he hasn't had a good night of sleep in years, how he has those intrusive thoughts all the time, and the list goes on. And that felt like a great encapsulation of many other conversations I had with many other animal rights activists, how their activism and what they've been through being just vegan has been haunting them. And every time I'm confronted with that experience, all I want to do is to say, you should become spiritual. You should find, some kind of spiritual tradition or religious tradition, because, and it's my personal bias, it has brought me so much in my life. It has enriched my life, and it has protected me against the harm that they are experiencing. But I can't say that to them. You can't just, cold call, pitch a spiritual life to people like that. I feel people are not really receptive to that. They take it as a joke. And so what is your opinion on that whole issue?
I think that you can say anything as long as you keep it an I message. If somebody was telling me that they were in that kind of distress, I would say, it's really tough. Something that I do is meditate or, whatever, and see how they take it. But I think people need different things. I mean, one of the people I admire the most who has done so much for animals is Ingrid Newkirk, and she's famously atheistic, which doesn't mean she's not spiritual. She might not think of herself as spiritual, but she is. She has a spirit of love. And certainly in the Judeo-Christian tradition, God is love. And if you got that, it doesn't matter if you have the God part, you got the love part. So you pretty much got both. I think that people are different and that some people do fine without something that they call a spiritual life. Maybe they are very, very involved in life on earth. Maybe in addition to their animal activism, they have some kind of passion for music or something like that that really keeps them balanced and kind of fired up. But I think all these things can be considered spiritual. I think for myself, maybe because I've been around this movement so long, I went vegetarian in 1969 and was doing protests and things in the early 70s. In fact, I had a funny experience a couple of years ago. Our previous dog had a really hard time with fireworks. And so on the 4th of July, we would find an old hotel in Midtown Manhattan that has these really thick walls and you can't hear the fireworks. So we were at one of these hotels and I was just there with the dog and I was bored. And I decided to look up my maiden name, myself with my maiden name. And I married my first husband in 1977. So that name was, way back. But it came up, and it came up with these animal rights demonstrations, because it was so unusual, like particularly the ones that we did at a livestock and horse show in Kansas City, my hometown. So I've been around it a long time. And I think then it was so weird and so out there that I don't think we got as heartbroken because it was just so new. It's like, of course nobody understands this because nobody knows about it. And now we're in a place where the term animal rights is out there. The word vegan is out there. There are videos all over social media. A lot of people have seen stuff and most choose to ignore it. So I think there is more cause for grief, maybe, for people coming into the movement now, even though we've made so much progress.
I agree. And thank you so much for mentioning that you can be an atheist and absolutely have a spiritual life. There's this concept, I don't know who is it from, but that there is a transcendent spirituality, which would be the y-axis, I think, and then a more horizontal spirituality, which is more about the way we relate to others and what connects us. And by others, let's include animals too.
Absolutely. Well, for me, it's a lot about, there's God transcendent. I have a degree in comparative religion, so I love these terms. But so many of the religious traditions would talk about God transcendent and God immanent. And to me, the immanent thing is really, really important because I think that's how we're connected to everybody else, all species, all nature, probably all atoms. And I'm reading a book now. It's so funny. This book was recommended to me in my 20s. And I must have leafed through it at some point at that time and just thought, oh, it's not for me. And now I've found it again. It's called The Impersonal Life. And you would call it channeled because it's, I guess, kind of like Conversations with God, which I never read, but it's as if God is speaking. But what is being said, and this book was written in 1914, written by or coming through, however you want to look at it, a Protestant clergy person. And the idea is that God or the divine or whatever you want to call it is within us, is really all that is. And what we're called upon to do is know that and express that. And that was a beautiful concept for me because I'm also very interested in yoga philosophy. And that's what that is all about as well. It's the idea that enlightenment, certainly in Vedanta and some schools of yoga, is to know that we are that. And to me, when we're doing something like animal rights activism, we're coming from that inner essence, whether we acknowledge it or not, but it's we're propelled to do things that we wouldn't ordinarily have the strength or the courage to do. We're able to go places that aren't uplifting, that are heartbreaking, if necessary, to do what needs to be done. And I mean, that's why, to me, somebody like Ingrid Newkirk is an atheist, but she's also a saint. It's like those two things can exist in the same place.
Then how do you explain the fact that most vegan activists I come across have no semblance of like spiritual life? They define themselves as, like you said, like Ingrid defines herself, atheist, secular, don't talk to me about meditation or whatever.
Well, I think part of it is that we do have spirituality and religion very tied when we talk about it. And people who grew up in a religion or who didn't, but just heard about religion as this odd thing where there's some kind of God off there somewhere that rewards and punishes people and is supposed to be love, but in many scriptures did some pretty awful things. And so I think a lot of people are like, no. And that's the one that allows this to happen to animals. So I think the big argument is, you just go where you want to go with your spirituality. As long as animals are being treated the way they are, there is no kind of divine whatever in the universe. But I think we can do that. And then we're just kind of alone and bereft with it. And I certainly don't understand animal suffering. I think that my studies into spirituality, and I've studied the religions of the world academically, but the two that are really prominent within me are Christianity, because that's what I grew up in, and Vedanta and yoga philosophy, because that's what I found as a young person and have been exploring ever since. So on my altar, which I'm looking at right now, right in the center is this picture, and you can find it online and you can order one from eBay, but it's Jesus in the Himalayas, or you could put in Jesus meditating with animals. And it's this beautiful, beautiful picture of Jesus, supposedly drawn from life when he was in the Himalayas during his last years. I don't know about that part, but he's in the lotus position, and there are birds around him, and there are little bunny, little lizard crawling on him, and there's a tiger sleeping beside him. And it's this beautiful image to me of what I think you and I are talking about, spirituality, and how it brings so much love for these animals. Another interesting historical tidbit around Christianity is that in the early Christian era, the first 200 years before the Council of Constantinople, probably, I think I said that wrong. Yeah, Council of Constantinople. Think that's right. But anyway, in the first couple of 100 years, There were so many vegetarians, and they were probably vegan because at that time in history, the idea that you would raise an animal for so-called byproducts, I don't think that would have computed. So they were vegan or certainly vegetarian. And we certainly don't have in the Gospels Jesus talking about being vegetarian. There's the one mention of after the resurrection that he may have eaten a piece of fish. I don't know. But what I do know historically is that a huge percentage of the early Christians were vegetarian on purpose.
Black Friday, wow, shop Wayfair now, month long big deals, yeah, these are steals.
70% less money spent.
You can't go wrong, check out this song. Best in decor, Black Friday scores,
garlands and trees.
Saving with ease,
lights for your house, lamps for your spouse.
Save at Wayfair.
On dining chairs, mattresses, two sheets, better you. Everything home, these things in chrome. Here's a quick clock, area roads, fast shipping, wow, Wayfair is how.
Win the season, win the, win the season.
Wayfair, 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 Wayfair.
And even St. Paul talks about that in his letters. Would you guys just stop the thing with all talking about your diet? There are more important things, because he was, you know, eating meat. But there were so many. There's a beautiful book called Vegetarian Christian Saints by Holly Roberts. Interesting woman, medical doctor. She's Jewish and interested in Christianity, and you know, I just love it when people have all these things combined. But it's so interesting to me, and when I think about that, it wasn't an edict of this fledgling church, but I think when somebody like Jesus, if he is at all who people think that he was, who I think that he was, they bring so much love that love remains on earth energetically. And when you are vibrating in tune with that, you can't harm, you can't kill. And I think that is actually why there were so many vegetarians. And so to me, as spiritual vegans, we can work alongside the vegan activists who don't have any interest in spirituality, but we can bring that other part. We can bring that uplift. We can bring that kind of healing energy. And yes, what happens to animals is unspeakable. And so we are doing on every level what we can do, and trusting that more people will come along and more will be done, and we'll get through this thing. We'll see animal liberation, not in our lifetime, perhaps, but at some point before too terribly long.
Let me get back to that argument the secular atheist vegans make, which is religion is responsible for animal exploitation. I do think there is some truth in that. But then when you just, you know, scratch the surface, there is so much evidence, so many passages from Holy Scriptures that support, and from all religions that support the vegan lifestyle. And so why aren't, you know, religious people more in tune with the vegan message?
Yeah. In 2019... my husband, who was 67 at the time, walked into this room where I was working, and he said, "I'm going to go back to school," which was, well, okay. I mean, people do that at all ages. And then he said, "I'm going to study theology." And then I almost fell off the chair, because I've always been very much into spirituality, and he was always very accepting. You know, that's Victoria, that's what she does, that's fine. I don't disregard it, it's just not me. And he said, "I want to understand how the religions of the world have so missed out on God's other creatures." So he ended up at the One Spirit Seminary and became ordained as a minister, interfaith minister. And I think that's really at the center of it, that people see what religions have done and have not done. And I think the main thing with animals is they've been used throughout history for human needs. And one could argue that there was a time when there was no other option for humans to get around, to have food, clothing, whatever. We live now, so what people had to do at some other time or some other place, I don't know if it's all that relevant. But I think, and it depends also on the religion and how animal lives are regarded, it's not hatred, it's not a focus. You know, it's like so many other things in life. You know, if you have a history, if you're really into a certain kind of music or a certain pastime and it's just all absorbing to you and somebody else has never even heard of it, and you think, huh? And yet, you know, they haven't. I mean, I met a cardiologist recently who had never heard of Dean Ornish. And to me, that's like an infectious disease doctor that's never heard of Louis Pasteur. But they're out there. Now, interestingly enough, this cardiologist is quite young. And I think that the vegan activists that you're talking about, for the most part, are also quite young. Because when I became vegan, it was very much about spirituality for a great many people. Because if you look historically at vegetarianism around the world, it was almost always tied to a religion. So the big surge, of course, was with the British first trade relationship and then colonization of India. And so there was this exchange of cultures. And people in England and people who could read English learned about the ideas of Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, the Ahimsa religions. They learned about vegetarianism, reincarnation. All this stuff was widely known in England and other places in the 1700s, 1800s. I mean, the history in colonial America was utterly fascinating. Do you know, for example, of a French Jesuit missionary named Sébastien Rale? Is that a familiar name?
No.
Well, I learned this because there's this very cool woman in Maine who researches vegetarian history of New England. So anyway, Father Sebastian came over to make all the native people become Catholic. But when he got here and when he met the native people, he realized that he had as much to learn from them as they did from him. He learned their language. He actually was killed in a skirmish when he took the side of the native people against the Europeans. But here's what's interesting. He was vegan. He was vegan in France. He was vegan when he came to America and wrote about that. And you find these people. I just wrote a blog post that I called 13 Million Points of Light, that as vegans, that's what we are. That we're these beautiful, radiant centers of hope and possibility. And for people in the Judeo-Christian tradition, anybody who's vegan and has a vegan home has recreated Eden, because Eden was vegan. Everybody was vegan. All the now carnivorous animals in the Genesis creation story were vegan. I mean, even after the fall, Adam and Eve, all the humans, they were still vegan, although they were now, you know, in a place where there's going to be sickness and death and trouble and all that. And the story goes that God said, okay, you know, now he didn't say it like this, but the way I say it is the Hawaiian vacation diet, the fruits and the nuts, that's not going to do it for you. You got to have some kale. And so, you know, the foods that before only animals, non-human animals, had eaten were then allowed for humans. And interestingly enough, even after the fall, according to the story, and I'm not saying that I'm a biblical literalist, but I just find these parallels so fascinating, that Adam and Eve and family were no longer in Eden. They were going to die. But everybody lived a really, really long time until the flood, when there was a dispensation for eating animals, and there you go. But I think that these kinds of influences brought the idea of ahimsa coming from India, and the idea of this reverence for life. It really pushed it out into the world. And so you had people like, there was something called the Bible Christian Church. It was really big in England, early 1800s, came to America. They settled in Pennsylvania because that was, the big freedom of religion state. And there were just so many others. And then you get like the Seventh-day Adventists who are still with us. And so what happens when you're a vegan is, to speak biblically, you're recreating Eden. You are bringing to life that Isaiah prophecy of the peace on earth when everybody lives harmoniously together. And it's not the whole planet right now. And it's not whole countries or whole cities. But every vegan household, whatever it looks like, is that little Eden. And there's something very powerful about that. And whether people want to say they're spiritual or not, that's a spiritual thing to do. And I just feel that overall, there's certainly a lot less religion in younger people than in older people. And there's less in my generation than in my grandparents' generation. But I do think the possibility for spirituality, because we really can find one that fits or craft something that works or combine things together. It's like there's no law that you have to put your spirituality into some very rigorous rule-bound structure. Although you can, and that works brilliantly for some people.
That Sebastian fellow reminds me of El-Mahdi, who was this poet and literary genius who lived in Syria, who was vegan, who wrote poems
Yes.
about his veganism. Interestingly enough, he is usually described as an atheist, but he was not. He would sleep on his prayer mat. He was a true believer. It's just that he practiced in his own terms, and I do find that a lot among vegan people who are religious and spiritual. They are heterodox in their approach to
Yes.
religion and spirituality.
Yes. Well, that makes sense because we have to be free thinkers or we wouldn't be vegan. It's still very unusual. We're a small percentage of the population. People still think we eat funny. It's still hard for a lot of people to celebrate holidays with their families. So we're kind of out there. And so the idea that we have that kind of character, and then we're going to walk up to really any religion and say, give me the rules, I want to follow every single one of them, that's probably not going to be the case with most vegans.
No, indeed. I want to get back for a second on the point about why aren't more religious people vegan.
Okay.
Do you think there is a bias among in the vegan movement, an anti-religion bias that stops us from talking about veganism in religious terms to religious people? So talking in their language. Because we have this defeatist attitude, those religions or those religious people just would not understand our way of life. Not only that, but they are part of the problem. And so, why would I waste time talking about veganism or convincing them to consider a vegan lifestyle.
See, that's not the movement that I'm seeing. And again, I think it's generational, because for me, well, when I became vegan, the American Vegan Society magazine was called Ahimsa, coming from the yogic term for nonviolence. Jay Dinshaw, the founder, the late founder, was very interested in Gandhi and this whole idea of peace, and Gandhi, of course, being vegetarian. He wanted to be vegan. Evidently, he had very messed up stomach, and so his doctors, you know, at that time, things were limited, and they told him he had to have goat's milk. And it is said that and he only would drink the milk of his own goat, that he know that she's with the kid and everybody's going to be okay. I mean, it must have been very complicated. But at one point, shortly before his death, he said, he called having to eat this goat's, drink this goat's milk, the tragedy of my life. This was after India split into India and Pakistan. And for somebody that was so interested in peace and harmony and oneness, and he had devoted his life to freeing his country from colonial rule.
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The RealReal. The RealReal is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The RealReal. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail? Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
And then that happens. You would think that would be the tragedy of his life. But he said it was taking the milk from the goat. So there was this very spiritual emphasis. In fact, my own first book, Compassion, the Ultimate Ethic and Exploration of Veganism, which I think maybe the first book on vegan philosophy and practice to come from an actual publisher, came out in 1985. That was written as a fellowship project for my bachelor's degree in comparative religions. If you hear funny little noises in the background, this is my dog snoring. So we're all vegans here. I think we can handle the dog snoring.
It's very cute.
My apologies. So, yeah. And so what I did when I knew I had this fellowship, and it was for foreign study, I had to leave North America to study anything that had to do with my major. So I went to the UK to study vegans, because at that time there were more vegans there and it was a smaller landmass and I could just do it better. But I was looking at them in a religious, spiritual perspective. And that made all kinds of sense. In fact, it made so much sense that my college gave me money to go do this when veganism was hardly known in the world, much less in America. And today, my husband used that ordination that he has to found, with another interfaith minister, Reverend Sarah Bowen, and myself, something called the Compassion Consortium, which is an interfaith spiritual center for animal advocates. So we're interfaith, which means anybody from any tradition or none is welcome. And we're interspecies, which means that we believe that animals have spiritual lives. You know, maybe not with sacraments and commandments and things like that, but there is something very etheric about them as well. And then we are interspiritual, meaning that we bring in traditions from around the world for meditation practices and so on and so forth. So I'm part of that. I'm also part of the Interfaith Vegan Coalition, which reaches out to all different kinds of religions. They have packets for broad religious bodies, and in some of the ones that are more prevalent in North America, like Christian denominations, for instance, they'll get them down even to denominational kinds of packets. And then there's the vegan spirituality, which was also a way to find vegans who have spiritual lives or want to have spiritual lives and bring them together. And I was also lead producer of the documentary, A Prayer for Compassion, which was produced in 2019. You can find it on Vimeo and elsewhere. And that's about spirituality and food choices. And again, to me, it made perfect sense. So it was probably 2016 when the filmmaker, Thomas Jackson, called into my, at that time, radio show. My Main Street Vegan podcast started out as internet radio as well as a podcast, and we could take callers. And he called in and asked if I would like to produce his documentary. And, you know, my first thought is, I don't know how to produce a documentary. But then he said, it's going to be about veganism and spirituality. And then it's like, yes, I will learn how to produce a documentary because those are my two passions. But there is that stuff out there. There's also a wonderful group in the UK called the Animal Interfaith Alliance, where some very high-level people in established religious bodies gather to try to change some of the things that is being done in the name of their religion or others. So there are people who care. It's so interesting that you seem to be seeing a lot of vegans who aren't interested in spirituality, and I'm seeing a lot who are. I don't know who's got the most numbers, probably you, but you know, we're certainly here. If there's somebody listening to this who's like, well, I'd like to be a spiritual vegan, but I don't know any. Well, there are all these places you can look and find your people.
I don't know. I wonder if this has been studied. It's just, you know, I guess my personal experience and exchanges I've had, and every time I produce a podcast about focusing on religion, I get so much pushback and so many negative comments, which I simply don't understand.
Yeah.
Because I have the same vision that aligns with yours, Victoria.
Well, I think a lot of people have been religiously injured. You know, they either had a religion pushed on them that didn't make any sense, or if they were gay or in some other way, knowing that who they were was something that that particular religion was disregarding, even condemning. You know, that kind of stuff is very difficult. And we know there's been clergy abuse of children and things like that. So I understand, you know, where some of it comes from. And yet, when we think about how spirituality can be so personal, and you can have all the joys of it. You know, it would be like saying, I hate music if the only music I had ever heard was marching bands. And I don't know anything about classic rock or Mozart. All I know is marching bands, and I don't like it. And so I think this whole realm of spirituality, it's so big. And the other thing that it does for animal activists and animal advocates is it can help us deal with how hard it is. You know, just knowing what goes on, it is very difficult. And so the idea that there is something more, that there is a way to get some kind of comfort so that we can just keep going knowing what we do. And I know people who are not interested in spirituality would probably just say, well, what a lightweight you are. You know, I just do it on my own. But I feel like anybody who is aware of great suffering needs some kind of help in dealing with that. And, you know, maybe there's just great personal strength that they can draw on. But I really like the idea of spirituality. And then, you know, I don't feel the need to turn to anything damaging because I can turn to this idea that I don't know anything about the great beyond. And anybody who says for absolute certain that they do, I think is kind of full of themselves. But I think we all have to create some sort of livable vision for getting through this life. And for me, spiritual teachings are just, they're just part of it. They're just so much a part of it. I think about when I was researching Compassion, the Ultimate Ethic in England, Scotland, and Ireland. And there was one woman that I met, and she had a bed and breakfast in northern Scotland, in Inverness. And she told me that she'd always considered herself a devout Christian, a member of the Church of Scotland. And then she had this experience where she said, "Thou shalt not kill," rang through my ears for a fortnight. And I went to this Church of Scotland clergy, and he said, you know, don't worry about the animals, you know, don't worry about what you eat. It's like, just, you know, get some rest and, you know, you'll get over it, basically. But once she committed that she was going to be vegan, it stopped. And she wasn't losing her mind or anything. But that was a spiritual experience that made one person vegan. And she is one of many thousands throughout history that something in their soul pushed them, moved them in this direction. And I think for people who are more scientific and more, you know, they're engineers and mathematicians and people like that, there are spiritual traditions that are just made for that kind of temperament. And I think of Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, the idea that you and the divine are one and your job is to, you know, determine that. There's a wonderful novel from the 1930s by Somerset Maugham, The Razor's Edge, which is based on those teachings. And there was a great old movie, if you like old movies, made from the book. And so it's just like there really is something for everybody if you want it and if you need it. And to me, the power has been shown. I mean, I think perhaps most recently in history is the 12-step programs, because before Bill Wilson had a spiritual experience that got him to stop drinking, alcoholics died or were locked up. That was the only hope. You were going to die or you're going to be locked up forever, throw away the key. That's it. Because there was no help and no hope. And then he had this literally spiritual experience. He saw a light in his hospital room, and the desire to drink was taken away. And other people, you know, it's not that simple. The desire isn't taken away, but the ability to show up a day at a time and not give in to it is. And that's a completely spiritual program. You know, it can be any, you know, they were back in the 30s saying, you know, God of your understanding. And they would say, if you can't do God, then make the group your higher power. It just has to be something that isn't your own ego. And, you know, there are thousands of people walking around, hundreds of thousands, who have gotten over all kinds of addiction because of this spiritual program. And it doesn't make them religious fanatics, doesn't make them pushy people who are, you know, closed-minded and can't stand people who are different from them. It's just another thing, you know, and it's sort of like, I think, in the world of people who are not interested in spirituality, there are those who are wonderful, kind, giving, gracious, funny, you love them to pieces. And then there are religious people who are kind, funny, gracious, you love them to pieces. And there are religious people that you just want to, you know, push them and their holy scripture out the door and close it, lock it. And there are, you know, non-spiritual people who are like that too. So I think we need to just be open to what gives other people peace and accept that if you're not a believer, those people at least have something that helps get them through life. And if you are one, to know that we don't know everything. We don't know how it all works. So, you know, God bless them too, even if you don't want to say it too loud.
Yes, I was thinking about this conversation, and I was wondering how would you define spirituality in the context of this discussion? And I was thinking about, you know, many activists being too close to the fire, too close to this horrific thing that animal exploitation is, and spirituality could allow them to take some distance, to have a sense of a bigger picture. And I do believe that adopting that attitude would also make them better animal activists, just because, you know, for one reason, they will be able to sustain that activism for a longer time and not be burnt out by their actions.
Well, that's certainly how I see it. And I know that everybody has to follow their own path and follow their own light. And I guess to me, that's really what spirituality is. Spirituality is acknowledging that somewhere within me, there is this pure, perfect light. And that's what I need to follow. And of course, oftentimes I don't, because I'm human.
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail? Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
And I mess up, but to just know that that's there and that's the essence. And I think, too, sometimes, like there's that phrase, the world is too much with us. We look at what we've got right here, and it's this infinite amount of time. And I know that when you're young, it's supposed to seem like forever because you wouldn't do all the work that it took to establish yourself and, you know, home and family and all that stuff, even if you're not trying to save the world. You know, it's a big deal to make a life and get through life. But as I look at it from my age now, 75, you know, this is a beautiful book by Joel Goldsmith, A Parenthesis in Eternity, one of my favorite book titles. But this really is a parenthesis in eternity. And so the idea that our lives only matter if we can change this thing right now. And I mean, of course, we all want to change it right now. Good heavens. I mean, that would just be the most amazing thing in the world. And yet, we're in this movement, and we don't know historically where we are in it. So, for example, If you were looking at slavery in the United States and you were an abolitionist and you were putting your whole life into getting rid of human slavery in this country, what year is it? Is it 1620? Is it 1750? Is it 1862? I mean, we don't know where we are is in the animal rights movement. And, you know, there's kind of backwards and forwards and up and down, and we think we're making a lot of progress, and then we have some backsliding, and which I guess happens in every kind of liberation movement like this. And this may also be the most revolutionary revolution that's ever taken place on Earth, because it's the only one that has been for others who cannot participate, who can't speak. I mean, you know, when we're talking about slavery in America, there was the Underground Railroad and there was Harriet Tubman and there were all these people who were enslaved or had been enslaved that were part of the cause. And with the other than human animals, I mean, they can be in sanctuaries being ambassadors and participating in that way. But this is huge. I mean, what we're trying to do, it has to do with people's diet. And I mean, trying to get somebody to change what they eat, even if it's not like veganism, just getting somebody to, you know, not eat desserts or something. I mean, it's like, you know, this is just really very, very difficult. We're also talking about getting people to change their attitude and step down from their super privileged position of we are human, we are above everybody, and come to more of a, yeah, we've got a big brain and an opposing thumb, but we're really an animal like everybody else. You know, these are just huge things that we're asking of people. So when we look out at our progress and get discouraged by how slow it is, and certainly it's as long as any animal is suffering, the progress is too slow. But on the other hand, we've got to give ourselves a break to understand what a huge undertaking this is. And maybe if we really saw how big it was, we would be overjoyed at the progress we're making.
Absolutely, and beautifully said. I want to address the question of animal exploitation itself. In many religious traditions, there is this idea of evil. Do you believe that what we're fighting is a form of that, of evil? And do you even believe in that concept of evil? Maybe not as a, you know, a real entity, but as a force of darkness in this world.
Well, there certainly seems to be that, a force of darkness in this world. And I'm always so surprised when people go there, and even outside the animal situation, but, you know, where people just choose to steal something from somebody. It's like, what? You know, why? I mean, it's just fascinating to me. And so I don't believe in evil as a force. I grew up, I was supposed to be Roman Catholic, but it never really resonated with me very much. And I had this nanny who was very eclectically spiritual, and she ended up in Unity, which is a kind of a progressive Christian denomination, which was actually founded by a couple of very strict vegetarians in the 1890s. Now, they weren't vegan because that concept just wasn't around then, but they absolutely did not eat meat and they didn't wear leather. They had a publishing company and they printed their Bibles and all their other books with this faux leather that was available in the 1890s. It's like, who knew? So, and they recommended vegetarianism after they died, and, you know, a son took over, that kind of fell away. But that influence, you know, was part of my childhood. And now I have gone so off on a story that I've forgotten what we're talking about.
Evil.
Evil, yeah, evil. Okay, so in unity and in all the what they call new thought traditions, religious science, divine science, even Christian science, to a degree, it's the idea there is, like, this is a unity thing. There is one power and one presence in all the universe, God the good, omnipotent. Now, that is really hard to say and believe when you're looking at an animal being abused or a child being abused or something else happening that just totally should not be happening. And so it requires the idea that there's facts, there are facts. And among the many facts of this world is that things are happening and have happened throughout history that were just wrong, that if there is a God, very much removed from God, just wrong. And I think in our own lives, we can look at things that we did and it was like, oh my goodness, can't believe I did that. And we learn and we change and, go on. And I think that that's what we're supposed to do as a society, too. One of my early spiritual teachers used to talk about the upward progression of the universe. We're supposed to be part of this upward progression. And I think that that's what we're doing in the animal rights movement. So, whether evil is a force, a satanic kind of force, I guess I would say no, because when I think of a force, I think of a creative power, and I don't see evil, creating life. But I do see things that are really bad, and you can call it evil, or you can call it wrong, or sick, or misguided, or whatever kind of word you want to give to it. But I do think it's our responsibility anytime we can step in for someone who's powerless. And certainly that's the case for animals in agriculture and experimentation and in so many other places where they should not be.
I don't know about your position on the supernatural and its manifestations. So, for instance, angels, ghosts, and all of that. But that is a question I raised to Akiva Gersh, also known as the vegan rabbi. I asked him, point blank, where is God right now? Why is he not stopping this animal exploitation business? Why is he not intervening? What do you make of that question?
Well, I think that there are two ways to believe in the traditional Judeo-Christian kind of God. And one is to believe that he, and I'll just say he, because if we're going to be that traditional, we may as well keep the pronoun, it can be changed or moved to come in and do something, stop something. And there's another view, I think it's called deism, that there is a God who created everything and set it into motion and gave humans free will, and we're supposed to be taking care of the stuff. And I do believe that sometimes there are remarkable things that happen, and the timing, like even in my own life, I'd gone to this PETA thing, saw a bunch of video of animals abused, but I'd already been vegan for over 30 years. I mean, I'd seen footage like that forever. It wasn't like it was new, but my heart was extra open that night. And so going home in the subway, I was kind of talking to God because I'm comfortable with the G word. And like, well, why can't I just give them $100,000? And the response was, well, here's what you can do. And it was literally inspiration. Your next book needs to be Main Street Vegan. It needs to have 40 short chapters because people don't have long attention spans. It needs to have a recipe at the end of each chapter because people really like recipes, and it needs to be geared to that young woman that you were in Wheaton, Illinois in 1983 when you went from vegetarian to vegan. And that was so clear. It was almost like I just take notes, like, okay, check, got that. And so I told my agent, I wrote a proposal. We got a really good publisher, Tarcher Penguin. But then the first time I talked to my editor, she said, "We're so happy to have you. We don't have a book on veganism yet." But then she said, "We hate Main Street." And I knew that was my title, and I couldn't very well say to her, but that has to be the title because God gave it to me. So it was just like, okay, they bought it. You know, I'm going to have to come up with another title. I was trying to write the book and come up with a title, and nothing sounded good. And so my husband and I are walking up Broadway after a movie, and there is Michael Moore. And he had liked another book that I'd written. So I gave my card to this woman who was with him. He was talking to some fans. And we went on up Broadway. And then I hear, "Victoria!" It's Michael Moore. And we started talking. And he said, "We need to talk about food. I'll call you." Well, miraculously, he did. And one night we're talking about food. And I told him this book I'm writing is supposed to be called Main Street Vegan. Publisher doesn't like that. He said, "They're wrong. Everybody wants to be Main Street. Let me talk to them." So I had this three-way call with an Academy Award winner, my editor, and me. He convinced her. She convinced the higher-ups. I got my title. And as soon as she called me and said, "Okay, the book will be called Main Street Vegan," I'm getting all these like bubbles, like, ooh, there should be a Main Street Vegan podcast. And in those days, there were only 4 vegan podcasts. I was number 5. So the idea, that was kind of revolutionary. There needs to be Main Street Vegan Productions. There needs to be a Main Street Vegan Academy, training and certifying vegan lifestyle coaches and educators. And it's like, yeah. And all that has happened. And it wouldn't have happened if we hadn't run into Michael Moore on Broadway. I mean, huh? Now, that's not like parting the Red Sea, but I consider it a vegan miracle. And I think it's important to look for them because I believe this is the time in history when it's time for the animals. You know, I've seen a lot of liberation in my life. You know, I've seen a lot of people, women and minorities of various kinds, not get to perfection, not get to the ultimate where it ought to be, but make tremendous, tremendous strides that were unbelievable. Would just wouldn't have believed it, like when I was a kid. And so I think so much can happen for animals. And if there is something like divine appointment and serendipity and a little bit of extra help from what some people would call the spirit world, I'll take it. I'll take whatever I can get to save these animals.
I love those stories. By the way, I don't know if it happens to you, but many times when I talk to atheists who just hate the idea of God, "Don't talk to me about religion," they know you're into spirituality, and so they will at some point whisper, "Hey, I have a story. I was visited by a ghost once. I'm telling you this, but you know, take it with a grain of salt. And I had this dream, which was a prophetic dream." And so yeah, it's always funny when that happens.
I think, you know, even the scientists that study the brain, they've found some section that, you know, I don't know if they call it the God spot or something, that it's, we're wired to be spiritual. Now, does that absolutely mean, yes, there is some, you know, God, Brahman, Ahura Mazda? I don't know, but I know we're wired for it. And so it kind of seems like it's not It's not that far off. And, in a way, I kind of admire people who can get through life and stay sane and remain effective and not believe in anything, because I couldn't. I mean, life can get really, really hard sometimes. And I think this is why so often people who have not been close to any kind of religion or anything, they have a funeral. They have, there's just when you're looking at coming to Earth and leaving Earth, it all gets very kind of, is this parenthesis all there is? And one thing for me, I was kind of a weird little kid. I always knew I was somewhere before this. So I would hear adults talk about life after death, and I would be thinking, what's the big deal? I mean, of course there's life after death because I was just there. And then I've heard this story, and it's probably an urban myth, but it's a good story of the little boy who goes into his baby sister's room and says, "Tell me about God, I'm beginning to forget." And I think maybe that happens.
It's not, it's more common than you think, that you might think. There is a whole subreddit online of parents and guardians, freaking out from interactions with children who talk about their past life, who describe things in details, who often share that they have been the relative of the guardian or the parent, there, I was your aunt, you don't remember me, or I was your father. Weird, weird interactions. And it comes from families from everywhere in the world, from every religion. For me, reincarnation is such a compelling concept. I really don't know why people, take it as a joke or as a non-serious idea.
I don't know if it was Thoreau, but some one of those folks said, "I don't think it is any more remarkable to be born twice than it is to be born once." So, and again, I was raised with it. This incredible nanny, brought me up with reincarnation, which, it makes more sense. I think we're always just trying to understand probably the inexplicable, but it makes more sense than one and done. And I may not know exactly how it works or the ins and outs or, where are you in between or how long are you there? And blah, I don't know, but it's my worldview. It's how I see things. When I was not quite three, because we moved on my third birthday, so I know I wasn't three. And my nanny took me out at night, and it was late. I mean, enough that it was completely dark and there were lots of stars in the sky. And I'm in my stroller looking up at the stars and thinking, okay, I mean, that's home. I'm here. I'm doing this thing. It's okay. But it is not home. And I remember that so clearly, which was, I think, when I decided, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to stick this thing out. And so, maybe some people are just a little bit more wired that way from an early age. I know it helps me. It helps me be a better person. It helps me get through things that are difficult, and it helps me be a better animal advocate. And, I'll stand with anybody who's an animal advocate, whether they have that piece going or not.
Beautiful. Let me end this conversation with this question then. You mentioned how you were inspired. The idea of the book was an inspiration, and this is an old, ancient idea, of the muse or the diamond, I think, from what's the name of that? I should not forget his name. The philosopher who, Socrates, yes, he had that daemon or demon, however you want to pronounce it. And he was the one, you know, giving him inspiration for his philosophy. How do we summon that spirit? How do we, you know, bring up those new and innovative and groundbreaking ideas? Is there even a way? Is it, you know, out of our control? And if there is, you know, what are your thoughts on it?
Okay, well, I don't think you can order it up like, you know, I'll have a veggie burger and a salad, but I think you can create the place where it might come. So for example, when my daughter and her husband bought their condo in New York City and it had a yard, nobody has a yard in Manhattan. So they were really looking for the kinds of plants they could plant that would attract bees. And I think that's what we need to do. We need to live a kind of life that attracts inspiration. So there are all different ways to live a spiritual life. It's not, you know, one size fits all. But generally speaking, in many traditions, some of the things that come across are that you get up early. Like in yoga, for example, there's this time of day called Brahma Muhurta, which is, I think technically it's like 2 hours and 40 minutes before sunrise. But even just 6 o'clock, you know, you get up when it's quiet and when it's just easier to access, you know, that kind of peace. And so you meditate and maybe you journal. Journaling is a great way to bring about inspiration because you're just writing and writing and writing. And then all of a sudden you write something like, what? Did I say that? And it's like, well, maybe it was me and maybe it wasn't, but it's good. I'm going to follow with that thing. And, you know, being with people who are uplifting, being in nature, just being an animal activist in yoga parlance is karma yoga. That's selfless service. That's doing something for someone with no thought of any benefit to yourself. That's, you know, that's a spiritual practice. And I think the more of that that we can incorporate into our lives, the more effective we'll be, and also happier and more content. Because the truth is, a lot of people, even ethical vegans who have done animal activism, we lose them. And we know our recidivism rate is, gosh, you know, worse than a lot of shrinking religions that will go unnamed. And so we need to nourish our fellow animal advocates. And one way we can do that is by being at peace ourselves, being a peaceful presence. And if anybody's interested, you know, sometimes people will say like, oh gosh, you seem so peaceful. What do you do? And it's like, well, you caught me on a good day, but here's what I do so that I have the good days.
Beautifully said. Victoria, did you want to add something before we end this recording?
Well, I'm just so happy that you have this podcast. And I love the idea that veganism, if we're going to save all the animals, we need all the people. So that means people who have no interest in spirituality and people who are just regular, conventional, whatever you grew up as, kind of religious, who knows, people who are really into meditation and enlightenment and all. We need the entire spectrum. And so to address part of that spectrum is to broaden it. I mean, the way I envision the world is that whether it's a Baptist funeral or a Hindu wedding or whatever it is, it's going to be vegan because that's what people of faith do. And because it's such a good thing to do, everybody's going to pick up on it. And then we're going to have a vegan world. So that's my vision. And I think that your podcast and all that you do in the world is helping us get there. So thank you.
Thank you to you, Victoria, for all the great work you have done throughout the years. I would not have been here if it wasn't for you. I'm, yes, sure of that. So yeah, like the saying goes, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants. So thank you so much, Victoria. Thank you for having answered my questions, and thank you for your voice.
My pleasure.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.